This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
Okay, so I've got a handout which gives my own solution to the problem. So at this point, don't alter your work, but We'll walk through the things, and you can compare what you've got with what I came up with. First of all, divide it up into atomic propositions. So we've got depart, one proposition, depart, one proposition, go out from there, one proposition. This is pretty easy. Do not touch what is unclean, one proposition, go out from the midst of her, purify yourselves. You who bear the vessels of the Lord. Now, that's our first problem in terms of propositions, because is this one proposition or two? Well, you've got one main verb, and then you've got a participle functioning in a noun-like way, the bearers of, in the construct, the vessels of the Lord. So this is functioning as a noun phrase that is the subject of purification here. Now, you could link them into one proposition. The difficulty is partly that this description of the addressees might apply to all these imperatives all the way up. And you don't want to jump too quickly to the conclusion that this is attached only to this one. There's, in effect, two analyses, one in which it would be attached to this one in which it would be attached to all of them together, because surely, in terms of content, the same people are being addressed in all of them. So I'm going to break it off, partly for that reason, in order not to prejudge the issue. Okay, now we're going to go down and start at the bottom and start linking things, okay? So, the Lord goes before you, the God of Israel is your rear guard. Clearly, complementary aspects of what the Lord is doing, and in the context, encouragement to go return from Babylon, or eschatologically to depart from this realm of sin and death and Satan. So these two things go together. They're parallelistic. They're linked with a vav, which is one of the ways of doing parallelism. And so that's pretty good. Now, trying to summarize it, really the Lord is doing two things. The Lord goes before, and guards in the rear. Okay, then these 12a and b. Not in trepidation you will go out, and in flight not you will go, clearly parallelistic. You will not go fearfully. Now, your own English summary, of course, might be a little different. Okay, so we do link all of 12 together, maybe, or maybe 12a and b might be more closely related to something that goes before. The verse divisions, although they go back to Masoretic tradition, so there's weight to them, but they're not, you know, they are later. So they're, and even if they were inspired, they wouldn't necessarily correspond to what we're looking at, which is content relationships. So you can't just go by that. But the fact is that all of 11 is a series of imperatives. And 12 is giving reasons to encourage the people to depart. So all of 12 really belongs together, and 12 A and B and C and D are linked by this key here, right? You won't go fearfully. Why should I believe that? Because of the Lord's help and protection, His presence. So those two things go nicely together, all right? And in summarizing it, you would say, bull, you will not go fearfully, for the Lord is with you in specific ways, which, I'm condensing in the summary. Okay, now we've got these imperatives. What do we do with them? And we've got the G, which is not an imperative. But the G, grammatically, as we've already observed, is giving information about the addressee here and possibly further up. The challenge here is we've got parallelism, but it's not clear exactly what. Depart, go out from there is still the same idea, right? A little variation, you could say. Do not touch what is unclean is a B part, because now you've got the issue of cleanness and uncleanness. Go out from the midst of her, where's that, Babylon, in context. So that's another A. Purify yourselves is again the issue of clean and unclean. And the G, of course, is our problem, right? Now, what do we do? That's not a simple A-B-A-B parallelism. And you could do it, you could reasonably do it one of two ways. You could say, okay, I've got an A-B here and a double A here, or I could view this as a sandwich and have three A's here. And if you had either one of these, they're both reasonable. The question is, which is more reasonable? And if you think about it, you got to pay attention to the details and think about what's going on. You have a double imperative to start out, depart, exactly repeated. Actually, the whole second part of Isaiah is divided up. A number of times, new sections are introduced with double imperatives. Rouse yourself. Right, get up, O Jerusalem. Remember that? And it's one of several examples. So that's saying something in favor of seeing this is a little bit different, because it introduces the whole section. It has that force to it. And then as you continue to go on, you get more detail. In effect, this whole thing is very repetitious. But by this point, you've got a little more. And you say, well, that isn't very much. Surely, if somebody's going out, he's going out from somewhere. Yeah, but the there is anticipating going out from the midst of her, which is this Babylonian captivity. And that's motivational and basically related to the purification uncleanness, because it's a land of idolatry, right? And the Jews who were not socially prominent would have had difficulties keeping their food laws and cleanliness laws in a foreign country of that kind. So you're getting more information. And you're linking the fact that physically departure from to the fact you're going back to Palestine, where the temple of God was formerly, right? And where God set it apart as his special land for this special people. So you're going back symbolizing restoring communion with God. So you're getting more detail. And this last part gets still more detail, because it's showing the necessity of purification. Now, that is partly an argument that this part is linked especially to here. Why should you purify yourselves? Well, there's a definite obligation coming from the law of Moses, right, for the Levites, that you have to be in a state of cleanness. You have to be consecrated, in fact, if you're going to do this special job. So the linkage here is more than to here. In addition, you can see not only is there more detail, but more space on the page, slightly, is taken in the later lines, except this one is very short unless you include this. And I think that is of some weight. It's not decisive. But if you include this and say this is really part of the same line poetically, then it's actually the longest of the lines in terms of number of syllables and so on. So it makes sense, I think, to link it this way. If you did it the other way, if you said, I'd link it to all of the imperatives, that's not bad. But here, okay, so purify yourselves. It's a niphal reflexive. You bearers, I'm not going to go into all the details, okay? And that suggests if we've got, well, and this more detail suggests, I think, you do it this way. So what you've got is a pure command to depart, and then some more detail, depart and don't touch unclean, right? And then the most specific is depart, and not only the negative, don't touch, and purify yourselves. And then this increase in detail you're doing, got out of the screen. You're doing three times through essentially the same imperative, but with more detail each time. And people can feel as they read that there's a bit of a climax, not, you know, a really strong one, but there's a bit of an extra emphasis the third time through. So I think that's the best analysis, but again, this was one of the more challenging parts of this exercise. And I can see some wisdom if you divide it up another way. All right, so finally we've got this final linkage. Oh, I got to depart and purify is the summary of the whole thing, right? And then you got to link these two together like this, okay? And you say, depart because God is with you. All right, so there you have your overall summary, right? And you could do an outline, and here's your theme, right? And two subpoints. One of which is, this is nice, indicative and imperative, right? It's the same structure as you find in the New Testament, of because Christ has redeemed you, therefore live a new life, right? So you've got some suggestion already. Well, here's how I might organize a sermon based on that. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, what I want you to, oh, yes. Yeah, we'll get to that next time. Make sure your name is on the paper, box number, pass your work left and forward. Keep the handout, because that's what we're going to use for the next stage. And I'm ready to give you the assignment for, now this is Friday, okay, so next Wednesday, take the sheet that I just handed you and assume that that's right. So you get a clean slate at this point. If you fouled up if you messed up completely. Although, let's see, you know, how many people got roughly there, right? Let's see. See, okay, so what that's saying is We are dealing with objectivities in the text, right? We're just not, we're not making this up, yeah.
Are there any more handouts we didn't get?
Oh, no. I haven't got any more here. There's, yeah, okay, thanks. The point is that, you know, there are things to be discovered, and partly this whole exercise is partly an exercise, if you break it down in observation, elucidation, and application. It's partly observation. You know, it's forcing you to pay attention to details and ask yourself a lot of questions. Now, obviously, you're moving toward elucidation and saying, okay, how does the thing fit together? But the desire, the goal is to think through the objectivities of how the passage fits together rather than how you make it, you know, fit together just in terms of your subjective appropriation of it. It's not without value to do a subjective appropriation and so on, but that's not our focus. Okay, so this handout, use that as your starting point. We've got some more. Okay, anybody need one? We've got all set. Take this and for Wednesday, fill in propositional relations and prominence. And let's see if I've got... so I'm shifting around here. Okay, no. All right, the assignment, yeah. There it is. All right, that's what we've done. So your homework is now to do rhetorical analysis of this passage. You've already got a tree. Assume the tree is right. And so on this thing, you will fill in, you start with that, add propositional relations and prominence. And if there's equal prominence, now some of these parallelistic things, you may feel it's about equal, then you just omit the marking. It's okay. But if even slightly you feel, okay, it's sort of weighted a little more in one direction, then mark it, right? And I'm using the notation N, nuclear. If you want P, okay. But the prominence, mark the one out of two or one out of three, because there's this one thing that's right, three rather than two. Okay, so that's it. That's your assignment for Wednesday. Now we're going to do one more here in class. I'm going to do one more analysis. And it will be First Thessalonians 1. And I'm trying to get the sheet that's appropriate. And it's in your syllabus, a copy of this sheet with the spreading out of 1 Thessalonians 1, 9 to 10, 10.30C, if you want to find it. Here's what it looks like. So this time we're dealing with Greek text. It is actually one sentence. And by and large, sentence boundaries are really grammatical boundaries, but they tend to match up with referential boundaries, that is, content boundaries. You can't depend on it every time, but in this case, we have got a single unit in terms of content, in terms of referential material. And I've spread it out on a page, basically making sure that verbs are on separate lines, but also lapping over lines whenever there was a line was too long. So I've got plenty of space out here to work. And where we're going, I'm already going to reveal what I think is the solution, 10.30D. You can see the tree with not only the tree structure, but with the marking for prominence and propositional relations. Okay, so that's where we're going. But now we pretend that we didn't know, right, that we don't have the solution. And so let's see. Yeah, here we go. So here it is. So step one, the difference I'm going to do, of course, it's going to be a little different because it's Greek rather than Hebrew, but the principles are the same. Obviously, you have to adjust to the genius of the particular language as God has given it as a gift to human beings. But what we're going to do different here is try to do everything together. And my impression is in Greek discourse analysis that you're taught to do that. I divide it in two stages, doing the tree and then adding the other stuff, okay? The advantage of that is you're not overwhelmed with having to think about all kinds of things at once. The disadvantage is that actually your decisions as to the tree structure should be influenced by what you think the propositional relations are and what you think the prominence is. If you do things all together, it's less likely that you'll have to backtrack at some point and say, really, I got the tree wrong, right? So you get a tree and then you start filling in propositions and you say, I'm not sure this is right. And so then you undo part of the tree. Well, doing it all together is actually, once you develop the skill, I think, is more efficient and gives you the value of judging the tree by propositional relations as well as the other way around. If you find you've done a tree, so let's picture it here. So, all right, so I got pieces of text here. And let's say I've got, you know, some more there. And maybe I've been able to fill in a proposition relation and prominence here. And then I'm looking at this, and no propositional relation seems to work reasonably. And maybe I feel I'm halfway between two or three of them. That may be a signal that you actually need the grouping this way, with this thing being the result, you know, these two being the result rather than just this one. And then you can see clearly, these are two related elements, with maybe this one being the more prominent. So rearranging the tree may actually clarify the proposition relations. It's no wonder you can't find clear proposition relations, because they aren't clear, because you've got the tree wrong, you see. So that's what I'm going to do here, is to do the whole thing. But obviously the first thing to do is still to mark out the atomic propositions, right? The level of generally a single clause, and build up from there. Now, I'm not going to get into it. You could go all the way down to the level of morpheme or term and, you know, then link everything together. But the clause level is a good level to start, because most of the action in the discourse analysis and proposition relations and what I'm calling rhetorical analysis is how the clauses fit together. So here we go. And by the way, you need a different set of categories if you're going to go inside clauses. There are some referential categories, but that's for another day, or rather another course. I do offer from time to time, it has been some years, a elective course on Greek discourse analysis where, you know, we just plunge into everything in minute detail. But this is enough for you. For this course. Okay, so they themselves
emphatic, perhaps. They themselves announce concerning us. Well, that's an incomplete proposition so far. What kind of visit we had to you? Now, there's clearly two verbs here.
But the hopoion eisodon here is sort of linking these two in a way. You ask, how am I going to do justice to this? Because this thing is sort of facing both ways grammatically. Well, this verb expects an object. We had something towards you. What did we have? We had a visit. And it's what kind of visit we had toward you, right? So this needs to go together. It goes together grammatically. This is an accusative that is expected as the direct object of echo. This is, the aorist. So
so that means this is one proposition.
And what did they announce? The they, maybe other Christians, but maybe actually the pagans as well, because this is an extraordinary thing that they have seen of how these people's lives were changed. You know, it is one of the attractive and notable things about the Christian faith to this day, right? So you get these teen challenge drug addicts, and they're turned around. Praise the Lord. Well, even the pagans are sitting up and listening. That's what Paul is talking about. What are they announcing? They're not announcing the visit alone. They're announcing the visit that they had. They're announcing this entire thing, right? So grammatically, you can say this whole clause is functioning like the object of this verb. And the way we do it in terms of reference, now, is to take this as an incomplete proposition, and we're going to have a complement relation, right? Because this fits in as giving more information about what they announce. So it's a complement relation, but we're not filling that out yet. All right? So what kind of visit, and how you turn to God from idols?
One proposition. To serve the living and true God. Now, zonti
is a participle. And participles, as you know, sort of have some verb-like characteristics and some adjectival or noun-like characteristics in terms of their function. This is more like an adjective, right? We could break it down into, you know, treat it as a separate proposition, but you just end up linking it back by complement relations. So because this is obviously a dative object of this verb, right, the whole phrase here. So it's better just to view this as a single proposition, and then we'll go on.
And to wait for his son from heaven, single proposition, whom he raised from the dead, single proposition, Jesus who delivers us from the coming wrath. Well, again, you could break that down.
Into more than one proposition, because there's this participle here. But once again, if you this is functioning in many respects more like an adjective. And if you did break it down, you just end up linking it back by a complement relation. It's detail about the wrath. So anytime you can save yourself effort and you have a pretty good idea, this all belongs together like this. Obviously, this thing is not going to link up here, but only to this part. Okay? So we've done our atomic propositions. Now we're going to start at the bottom and link back. Well, we've got a challenge here. And in Greek, Hebrew tends to have these short clauses and many times what are called paratactic. They're just laid alongside one another. Greek has these complex sentences with many embedded clauses. All of that gives you clues as to the proposition relations, as doubtless you've discovered in Greek discourse analysis in your Greek course. So here's an accusative, which links back to this one, right? Which links back to his son. So his son, whom, right, he raised from the dead, Jesus. In apposition, basically, I'm saying something more about the same person, namely that he's delivering us from the coming wrath. So here's past accomplishment, and you can see, theologically, you know that the resurrection is the foundation for the assurance that we have that Jesus will deliver us from God's wrath, right? He bore God's wrath on the tree, that is the basis for delivering us. So theologically, you could say, oh, this is a cause and this is the effect, or maybe a reasoning relationship, a hence relationship, right, based on the cause and effect, right, of saying, therefore, right, because he's raised from the dead, therefore. But is that here? You know, it's there somewhere else in the Bible, right? We know all this stuff from the New Testament. But is it here? Well, it's in Paul's theology, right? You can go to the book of Acts and find various things as well as in some other letters. But what about, you know, you want to do justice to this particular verse. And when you ask yourself honestly what's going on, Paul and God speaking through Paul doesn't unpack any of that. He's just laying these things side by side. God raised Jesus from the dead. This is the one point. And Jesus delivers us from coming wrath. And these things are, it's apposition, right, in terms of the grammatical structure. Two things, two distinct things. You're not saying the same thing twice, okay? Two distinct things, both of which are central elements of the Christian gospel which Paul proclaimed. The relation, I believe, is topical. Now you say, well, maybe temporal relationship, right? The resurrection is past and the deliverance is future. It's so after relationship. No, we're not dealing with a narrative, right? So I don't think the temporal, it is true there is a temporal relation, but I don't think that's in focus, right? So you've got to think about what function these two things have. And I think they are just two things side by side, like this, and. All right, as two parts of the gospel. Which is more important? Which is more prominent? Oh, and let's summarize. God raised Jesus from the dead, and when you... And Jesus delivers, right? There's very little way to condense this, us, from wrath. Okay, two different aspects of the gospel. Which is more prominent? Well, very hard to say. Either of those can be more prominent. Clearly, this one, redemptive historically, is at the center. This one is at the center in terms of application, right? And the relevance of the gospel to living and breathing and sinful people. And this takes slightly more space, although that's partly a function of, you know, longer words and that kind of thing. So, and what about the relationship to the preceding part? Well, conceivably, because this one is looking future, conceivably this one a little more prominent because it has the link, you see, with we're waiting for Jesus to return, right, which will be the final deliverance.
So maybe, I didn't, in my solution, I didn't mark it because it just, both things are clearly important. Okay, so let's take this one. The Thessalonians are doing two things here, and you can see the structure. We've got two infinitives here, both of which are dependent on a finite verb back here. How you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God and to wait for His Son from heaven. And then following on that, you've got this relative clause, whom, referring back to His Son. What's going on there is you are providing more information. The grammar is clearly showing you're providing more information about His Son. So you should be thinking complement, right? And particularly the linkage is there, not to these two together, because this is about God the Father preeminently. This is about the Son, and it's really the Son that you are focusing on in this further information here, right? So you got to think, do I link these two first, and then both of them being supported by this extra information? The answer is no, right? Because of the differences and because of the linkage grammatically, is it to this one? All right, so what is the linkage? Well, the grammar pushes you in the direction of saying it's a complement relationship. But whenever you have this kind of thing, more information, you can ask, is this random information? Usually not. Is it the cause or reason for this? Well, it's close to being the reason. Or maybe the cause too. Because why are you waiting for the Son? Because you know that these things have happened, right? In this case, I don't see it, however, as being that much of an argument, right? You're not arguing. You're not trying to convince the Thessalonians. You see, that would be the hence relationship. You're not trying to convince them that they are, in fact, waiting for the Son. They're already doing that. They know that very well. So I'm just going to leave it as a plain complement relation, although having considered the possibility of something else. Now, in a complement relation, the grammatically superordinate piece here is usually the most prominent. Now, we've got going against that this is now rhetorically a little fuller material on the page. But if you think of what this whole sentence is doing, this is not really a presentation of the gospel, primarily. There's pieces of the gospel here, and it's implied by the fact that this visit is that we had, it's Paul and his cohorts, okay? So they came, they proclaimed the gospel, that's certainly in the background and pieces of it here, but the focus is really on the Thessalonians' response, and that this is drawn in as further information about just what are they responding to, and you know, what is the larger picture of their response. So I do think that there's considerable reason for saying that this description of the Thessalonians is the more prominent. You say, what, aren't we theocentric theologians who believe that the work of Christ is more theologically central than human response? Yes, theologically, no, rhetorically, right? It's the same kind of thing we've seen before, that God and Paul, through whom God speaks, at this particular point in the letter to the Thessalonians, is focusing on their response for reasons related to encouraging them exhorting them to continue in the faith, but at this point it's a kind of a historical reflection. And you'll get to the exhortation in the second half of the letter. Okay, so there we have it, and we summarize saying, you wait for His Son. And I actually didn't conclude all this, wait for His Son. I didn't include all this extra information about the Son because I do regard it as subordinate. All right, and you serve the living God, and. Now, your conjunctions are very important, right? Now, chi can have another functions, but clearly you're dealing with two parallel aspects of the Thessalonian Christians responding, right? To serve God instead of idols is in the background, right? To serve God and to wait for Jesus' return. Two aspects side by side, topically related, I believe. So you just say and. Not in other words, because it's two different aspects. And which is more significant? Well, they're both significant. I'm going to go for the fact that this one is rhetorically a lot more space on the page, right? And that by itself suggests that of the two, it's more prominent. Although, you know, here, turn to God from idols, that's really more closely related to this. So that, yeah, it makes it difficult, right? Because this has the linkage. Okay, so we have that. And then you turned from idols to serve. Okay, so you got two infinitives here, right? We've got serving and waiting. Those infinitives grammatically are both dependent on this verb, not on all this other stuff, right? And how do they function? Look it up in Burton, and you will see that infinitive independent clause, one of the main functions is purpose. You turned to God in order with the intention, which of course they actually carried out, right? In order to serve the living and true God and to wait. So, oh, I need to summarize. You serve God and wait for Jesus. Wait for Jesus. All right, and then that, in turn, is linked to this part. Not to the full thing, but to this, grammatically, and intending. Now, the intending relationship has an intrinsic weight where this part is more likely to be more prominent. Okay? And this is also grammatically the main verb. And it gets hard because the rhetorical fullness gets down here, right? All of this spelling out just what are the consequences of the turning. So you could go either way. But if you think about the whole verse, they themselves, that is others, tell the news about this visit that Apostle Paul and others made and the Thessalonians' response. And really, this sums up the response. So I think there is reason to think that it is the most prominent part. And so you turned to God. And the rest of it is spilling out in some detail just what are the consequences and what is the fleshing out of that. Okay, what about this part? Well, what do they announce? Do they announce the visit? Do they announce the turning on the Thessalonians' part? They announce both of them, right? This is the pokes. How, right? So they're announcing both aspects. That means I've got to link these two first and have them together as the object of this verb. So here we go. All right? And what's the relationship? Well, go in here. And you've got a chi, which is pretty colorless. And you say, okay, they announce two things side by side. But here you've got the beginning of what looks like a narrative. Because the visit comes first in time, right? So Paul and his companions arrive in Thessalonica.
Okay, hi, except they don't just say hi. They proclaim the gospel, which results in this response. And it's not that far, even though chi is colorless, it's not that far below the surface to understand this is the response to this. It doesn't make sense otherwise. And that kind of response I call a cause-effect relationship. Again, it's one of these things, it's not one billiard ball responding to another, right? There's human responsibility and choice, but there's still a causal relationship. So I think that is, you could label it as just after, right? Or just side by side as an and. But I think there is, even though the linkage is chi, you can see that it is, in terms of its content, saying that this follows. This was a response. And so you visited and, or they, let's say we. Yeah, it's we. We visited and you turned to God. My handwriting is not very good. My apologies. Okay. And that's what's announced. All right, the whole thing. Okay? And this is an incomplete proposition. They announced X, right? Complement relationship. The arrow goes upward to indicate that this is the including proposition, that, right? And this is more information about a piece of that proposition. And it's grammatically superordinate. So you say, okay, that's got the prominence. No, because it's one of these verbs of saying or thinking or hoping, right? It's the regular exception that's a content of what they said. And it's pretty clear if you think about, you know, what Paul is talking about, that people are announcing all kinds of things, right? Gossiping about the latest stuff. What difference does it make? Well, this, you see, it's because of what they said, right, about the Thessalonian Christians that's of interest. Okay, so we've got it, and now we've got a tree, and oh yeah, we got to summarize. So they announce that your visit, where our visit, and that you turn to God. All right, so start here and go down, following at each branch the more prominent of the two, right? And so, I link that. It's clear that note that, but it's clear the Thessalonian response is in view, right? That's what startles these things. There are wandering preachers and philosophers in the Roman Empire at this time. No big deal, right? If the Apostle Paul and his companions are just one more set, what made people listen, what made people sit up and gossip about it, gossip in a good way, was the response. We've never seen people respond this way and have their lives changed. So we've got the response here, and at the very center of it is the turning to God from idols, which makes sense. And you've also got the potential, although your sermon is going to be a little lopsided if you just use this outline. And this tree is not a pretty tree, aesthetically, right? You like to see trees that are neatly balanced, right? And this tree is all on one side. It's the other way, right? It's like this. And that's why I started at the bottom. Because if you start at the top, you have something, you say, okay, they announced our visit, right? So you got this. No, wait a minute, they announced the visit and response, right? Oh, but this response has more detail to it. You know, you keep having to include more and more. When you start, if you started analyzing this thing at the top, it's very hard to discern how much of the stuff is included. If I start at the bottom, I've got something reasonable, right? Something smaller, and I won't wear out my eraser. They'll do it in pencil, is my principle. Now you'd say, okay, well, that's all, that I understand now why. My advice is start at the bottom and work backwards, which seems, you know, it seems illogical because everybody reads through passages from top to bottom. So why start at the bottom? Because for this tree analysis, it actually works more efficiently. And you say, well, wait a minute. What if you actually had a tree like this? Then it would have been better to start at the top. You're right. Trees like this do not exist, practically not at all, in any discourse throughout the world in any language. There's something about human communication and human memory, right? If you start with a detail and then way, way onwards, right, tell people what the main point is, their minds are going crazy trying to process this. So there is, because of the finiteness of human memory at least and various things related to that, it actually there is a tendency. Now it's only a tendency, right? So it isn't as if you won't sometimes start out with a detail like that, right? But then you'll have some more detail like that, right? Because at some point, the author of the communication will have mercy on you, right? And tell you something of the main point before you get all the way through. And it seems particularly in Paul's writings that he will develop a main point and he will tack things on just like this quite frequently. Now, again, that's just a tendency. So anyway, it does, on the average, you know, you never know how a passage is going to turn out when you start. But on the average, you're going to use your eraser less if you start at the bottom rather than at the top. That's the principle. Okay, now, I did this. Now, remember, the point is...
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.edu.